I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
New on the podcast, author Madeline Borcaro on Yoko Ono.
It alienated a lot of people because they couldn't take it.
Loved by some, vilified over the years by many.
They have this hatred of her already, and it just comes up as another example of why they wouldn't like her.
Whether that's because of sexism, racism, misogyny.
As soon as she married John, she wakes up the next day and the whole world is her mother-in-law.
Or maybe people didn't like her output.
She wanted to show people what they had done.
One thing is true, she's viewed very differently today. So Madeline Borcaro, welcome. This is an immense pleasure because you have written a book, and the book's title is In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. It's an amazing book. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And for me, well, first of all, I mean, it's been acclaimed by Mojo, and it's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame library of archives, and deservedly so, I would say. The detail is incredible in the book, and it's a bit like a, in a sense for me, it was sort of like a love letter to Yoko in terms of her life, her art, her music, and of course it contains the story, the love story between Yoko Ono and John Lennon. I just want to say, first of all, that if anyone's interested in the book, I've got all the links below where they can buy your wonderful book. So we can mention that a few times, but I just wanted to say that straight away, and they're all down there. Okay. I want to start with you and ask you about your upbringing and whether you were brought up in either a musical or a culturally interested family.
My parents were into music, but not the music I became interested in. They were into opera, Italian singers, Frank Sinatra. And they were always playing music, especially on Sundays while my mom was cooking. And I appreciate it, but I got into rock and roll pretty early on.
But they did see some value in culture. That's if they were interested
in
that way.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. I just want to ask you, because when I was a teenager and I was a fan of David Bowie, and he represented more than just his music to me as a gay teenager at the time. He represented this world where I could belong rather than the world in which I was. And I know that you encountered Yoko Ono's work when you were quite young. And I just wondered what this figure meant to you in retrospect.
Kind of the same thing Bowie meant. I was a Bowie fan at a young age as well. I mean, just the otherness, and I kind of identified with her as I was an only child, and I was looking for maybe a sister. And I just kind of clicked with her messages and her art and her music later on. But I really first got into her because of her films. I had seen a picture of her in front of her Bottoms film, and I thought that was a really interesting thing for someone to have done. And I just started following her from there. And the next thing you know, she was with John Lennon. So that was great because I could get all the news about her and see what she was up to. And I followed everything from, I was 10 years old in like 1968 when I discovered her.
She was brought up in a very wealthy family. She had an absent father because he was away working. And this family was very different because it was the upper class in Japan and in a sort of class system society. And she was a very lonely child. Can you tell me about her early years and how you think that may have really defined her later work?
Yes, she was in one of the wealthiest families in Japan, and people think that's an envious thing. But for her, her mother was a socialite, her father was a banker, he was never home, he was never in the country. He was in America a lot, and he was actually a prisoner of war during the bombings of Tokyo. And, you know, she had a really rough childhood. And John had a similar thing where his parents both literally abandoned him. And he later became closer with his mother, and then she was killed when he was 17. So they both had this abandonment issue. They were both always kind of in survival mode, you know, and for her, she had therapeutic ways of dealing with it. She started creating and doing the art, which a lot of people didn't understand at first. John was just raging. You know, he was trapped in the infamy of the Beatles and he was looking for something else. And when they met, they really, you know, saved each other. They completely clicked and understood each other on a humanistic level and also on an art level. And in their humor, everything was just amazing. And it's just an incredible love story woven throughout the book.
I mean, there is this point where you really understand how lonely she must have been as a child. How did that exhibit itself, and what did she get into because of this loneliness?
Well, she was brought to America because her father had been working there, and she was really an outcast in America also. And when the American hatred of Japanese occurred, they all returned back. So not only was she lonely, but she experienced discrimination, even at a young age when she was evacuated during the war to the countryside with her siblings. The children there wouldn't give them any food or anything because they considered them to be, too upper class, and threw stones at them. So she was getting it from all angles. And then later on, it was racism and sexism and lies were written about her. So many lies. And you have so many people still walking around with this anger towards her for breaking up the Beatles or for monopolizing John Lennon. And, you know, it's really hurting these people to carry this anger, which is based on lies. And she really, really was a wonderful woman who cared about John immensely. Even after his death, she dedicated her life to sustaining his legacy.
I mean, you mentioned she was foraging for food for her siblings during the war. And then I believe it was after the war when she went back to Tokyo, and she went to school with Emperor Hirohito's sons. What has she said about her school years and how they were?
Well, she, of course, one of the sons had a crush on her, and they were really good friends. But then she left to study philosophy. She was one of the first philosophy students. So she was into her own world. She was into Buddhist philosophy and just writing her own poetry and writing books. And when she was experiencing those war years, she thought to herself, I'm going to write about this so that she could kind of make it subjective and not have to feel how painful it really was. And she was going through it as if it was a movie, you know, an experience of someone else. And that was her dedication to expressing her own self.
You've created the book in a way under certain subject headings instead of having a sort of linear story of her life. What was the thinking behind the way that you have created this book?
The book kind of existed without me knowing it. I'd been writing articles about her all my life, some for publication, some just to, for my own memory. Like if I'd gone to a concert, I'd write about it, or an album, what I felt about it. And I had gotten some software where I could dump all these Word documents I had into this software and arrange them. And they were all short stories. And it's a good thing, because a 500-page book, page one, day one, Yoko Ono was born, and then going 91 years, nobody could do it. I had to just put it all together as a jigsaw puzzle, the way it fit. And it is chronological somewhat. I mean, it flows. So that's how that came about.
I mean, there are exceptional stories in the book that make up an exceptional life. And one of them was about someone she was in school with. If I get the name right, Yukio Mishima.
Mishima, yes.
Mishima, okay. Can you tell me his story and what happened later in life and the impact on Yoko?
He was a very famous author in Japan. He was very political, let's say, and he actually staged a coup and kidnapped some, you know, political officials and beheaded himself in their office. He just took a stand. But his life was based, and his writing was based, on using his own blood and his life flow. And that's the similarity between them. But she and he did not really jive, because he was kind of a macho guy, and he kind of ignored her when they were ever in a situation. But I just put him in there because they have so much in common, in that they dedicated their whole life and soul and blood to their work. And he did kill himself in the end, which she had, you know, a couple of suicide attempts when she was younger as well. But luckily, you know, later on, she couldn't understand how someone could kill themselves.
I mean, her work is often connected to the elements.
Yes.
And I just wondered, did that come from a very young age, and this idea that she was lonely, so she sort of connected to different things rather than to people?
It comes from the Japanese aesthetic, where that every object and thing has a soul, and she's very intuitive with nature. There's a whole chapter about how nature influenced her work, and also a chapter about how Japanese influence is very heavy in her work. So, you know, it's all a Japanese aesthetic, but also, you know, just how wise and intuitive she is. She'll say things like, water is more valuable than gold. And you think about that, and we don't think that way. We place the money on gold. But, you know, she's just very, very wise. And this is why I wanted to write the book, to bring that out, and we can learn so much from it. And she's so positive. She turns almost every negative into a positive, and it makes perfect sense the way she does it.
One of her early pieces, I suppose you can, early pieces of art, really, because it was one of the first things she did, which was cutting seeds and putting them together to create something new. Can you tell me? Yeah. So can you tell me about that? And also, really, the symbolism of doing that.
So she was a young child. She was like 5 years old in the garden with her mother. And she was looking at the trees, and she said, well, what if I take a seed from this tree and a seed from that tree, and I make would the fruit become different? And that's how she got the title of her book, Grapefruit. And she always felt like a hybrid of East and West, you know, and she just planted the acorns. That was part of the continuing nature theme. You know, they planted, John and Yoko, acorns, one facing east and one facing west. And they mailed acorns to world leaders to plant trees after that. So it was just her connection with nature. And of course, there are hybrid trees. She didn't know that at the time, but she thought it was her invention. And she always felt like a Madame Curie, that she was discovering things all the time.
I mean, it was in Grapefruit. I remember reading it, and it's the story of her lying down and looking through the hole in the roof.
That's another artwork of hers. It's called Hole to See the Sky Through, and it's a postcard with a little hole in it. And everybody thinks, oh, this is cute, I'll look at the sky. But what it represents is when she and her younger siblings were evacuated to this farmhouse that was very run down, and they were laying on the backs looking up, and there was a hole in the roof, and all she could see was the sky. And that to her was the most beautiful thing that she would see for a year while she was, you know, foraging for food with them. And it gave her hope, like the sky would always be there.
What did New York mean to her when she first went to New York?
Well, she was an artist when she arrived in New York, and it meant a lot more people who were up for her ideas in a way, because Japan was kind of, you know, thinking she was a little strange. But she came to New York, settled in Greenwich Village, and jumped right in. She started exhibiting at this Paradox restaurant. She was doing her bag piece at Judson Church. She did a thing at Carnegie Recital Hall. And then she got her own building, her own apartment, where she gathered all the avant-garde artists so they could perform, because there were no venues for them at the time. There was only, you know, Carnegie Hall and like jazz clubs and things like that. But she thought, well, wait a minute, people, you know, need to perform their work. And she opened this space. She was kind of like the first person to do a meltdown festival, you know, in her own little apartment.
I mean, her work is unfinished in a lot of ways. What is the thinking behind that?
Well, she wanted people to participate. She didn't want, you know, it hanging on a wall to be admired. That's not her idea of art. It's interactive. It's, you know, what you make of it. And she liked that idea that, you know, it would just be your own interpretation. She would guide you towards the positive, but she would have half a room, and it had objects cut in half and painted white. And she was hoping that you would focus on the half that's missing, not the half that's actually there. Because that's what she sees. And that whole thing represented her loneliness at the time when she separated from her husband, Tony Cox. And she'd even say the piece that's missing actually has a vibration like music, because that's how intuitive she is. She just would feel a vibration from something that's not even there. She always saw negative space and could really relate to it.
I mean, she had a real ability to turn trauma into something positive through her art, didn't she?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, that was amazing. We'll talk about a few of those things. But I just want to ask you about George Makiunas, if I've got that right again, who founded the Fluxus movement. And she was connected to him. And this was experimental art. And it also had some sort of unfinished process to it. It was mainly men. So how did she feel to be part of this movement? And you mentioned sexism. I think later there was real misogyny, of Yoko Ono. And it was a terrible thing that was going on. But I just wondered how she survived in this male world.
Well, it was just as bad back then in the late 50s, early 60s. She did connect with Makiunas, and they were really kindred spirits. He gave her first exhibition in New York City, and he manufactured some of her objects for her. But it was a man's world. She had been touring with her husband, Toshi Ichinagi, and John Cage all over Japan, Mayuzumi. There was all men, all in New York. So one of the reasons she tried a suicide attempt was because of this, when she returned to Japan very despondent, because she couldn't get out of that world.
But she felt unimportant, didn't she, in their art? So where did that come from? Was it just her feeling? Was she underused? Were they actually not looking at her as not important? Was that really the case?
Not that she wanted to be used in that Fluxus movement. She was part of it, but she was always kind of separate. She didn't want to be part of a thing. She was her own independent entity. You know, she didn't appreciate collaborating at the time. So she just became despondent because she was doing these group things with them. And he did give her her first exhibition. And then she went to London because that's where it was happening. And that's when she met John.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a second. But there's one piece which I completely adored, which was called Cut Piece. And it's an incredibly brave thing to do. Can you tell me why this is so brave? What exactly happened on stage?
So it's where she wears her best outfit because she wanted to give the best of herself. And she places a scissor on the stage in front of her and invites the audience members to come and cut a piece of the clothing. And a lot of people think it has feminist overtones, which it obviously does, but I don't think she meant it that way. It was more of a idea of an artist giving of themselves, like in the sense that Buddha gave everything he had. So, you know, this was the thing. And then in Japan, when one of the first times it was performed, a guy took the scissor and made a motion like he was going to stab her. So, of course, there was a dangerous element to, you know, what people are going to do. And she continued to perform that, you know, and actually Charlotte Mormon performed it many times. She was another, she coordinated all the avant-garde art festivals. And she was amazing. They were very close friends. And Charlotte performed Cut Piece throughout her life as well. Yoko did it later in Paris. And she had Sean standing there with her in case anything went wrong. But nothing ever did from, you know, that first experience.
I mean, it's an immense amount of trust between her and the audience in that piece. And that's why it always fascinated me.
Yes. A lot of other artists have performed it as well recently.
Now, it came through John Cage, I believe, or for John Cage. They were collecting lyrics or musical pieces?
It was actually, manuscripts. It was John Cage's birthday, and they were, her and a bunch of artists were collecting manuscripts from other musicians and artists to put together in a book for him. So she was told to approach Paul McCartney, and she did. But Paul said, well, what do you mean? I only have like written words because the Beatles didn't write notation. And she said, well, that's fine too. And he said, well, go to John Lennon, go see John about that. Cause Paul notoriously hoarded everything he ever wrote. So before she could go and seek out John, she was setting up her first art exhibition in London at Indica Gallery, which was run by John Dunbar, who was a friend of John and Paul, who I had the pleasure of hanging out with in London last summer. He's so wonderful. And so he introduced them, and Yoko was not too pleased because she was setting up the exhibit. She didn't want anybody to really see it yet or interact with it. And John was wanting to do everything. He wanted to hammer the nail in the painting, and she wanted it all to be pristine for the next day. But he climbs up the ladder and he looked at the magnifying glass and saw the canvas with the tiny little words that said yes, and he was drawn in. And then he took a bite of her apple. That was her artwork, and she was a little upset. But, you know, then it took 18 months for them to actually get together.
This ladder had a story of its own, didn't it?
Yeah, it's funny. There's an interview where she's talking about, they're asking her, hey, you know, you had this neighbor, right? Didn't you steal his ladder for? And she said, well, we didn't really steal it. We borrowed it. And I thought he would be thrilled to have it in an exhibition, but he was kind of angry. So we had to get him another ladder.
John had already sung Help, which was sort of a sign that he wanted out of the Beatles. Was he a broken man when he met Yoko?
He was, and Klaus Voormann, the bassist who works with him later on, was saying that, you know, all this fame and money and adoration meant nothing to him. He was really not functional, and that's when he met Yoko, and then they did the primal scream therapy together, and Klaus was saying that, you know, he could barely even leave his room. He was just so a ball of anger.
Was she a broken woman?
Well, she had her share of rejection. She had that crazy childhood. And, you know, at the time, you know, she was doing okay. She had her first London exhibition. She had gone to Paris and collaborated with Ornette Coleman. And she was not even considering going back to London. especially because she felt this magnetism between her and John. And she thought, well, if I get together with him, it's going to be heavy. And how am I going to continue my work? And but it was inevitable. They were writing letters to each other, and then they inevitably got together.
I mean, we talked about her loneliness as a child and something that must have continued throughout her life. How did meeting John change her perspective on loneliness?
He understood her. That was the crux of it. When he climbs up that ladder and he would do like silly things to make her understand that he got it all, you know, and the first thing he said was he wanted to hammer that nail. And she said, well, it's 5 shillings. And he said, well, can I give you an imaginary 5 shillings and an imaginary nail? And she said, oh my God, he really gets me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Her first child was taken away from her when the child was 6 years old. I mean, this is not just an amazing story, but it's such a human tragedy that someone's child is taken away. And at one point, she even put out an advert to try and get in touch with her child again. Can you tell me that story and how that eventually resolved itself?
So she and her husband, Tony, he was an American. He was kind of her promoter. They had a daughter, Kyoko. And when she was about 5 or 6 years old is when Yoko met John. So at first, Tony was kind of palling around with John and Yoko. But he saw that they were having a lot of trouble. You know, they were doing drugs. They had this infamy, you know, and he didn't think that was a good environment for the girl because he had raised the daughter just like John raised Sean later on because Yoko was doing her work. And he decided he didn't want to have any part of John and Yoko anymore. And he took the girl and they disappeared.
And what was he worried about? Do you know?
Maybe that she would think of John as her father now instead of him. You know, I'm sure there was some jealousy involved and maybe just for protection of her too. It was a bad thing that he did, but I don't think he intended it to be an evil thing. He just said, no, I'm going to, you know, raise this girl. So he took her away and John and Yoko spent so much time and money legally to try to find the girl, and Yoko legally won custody, but they were never able to find her. They did at one point briefly, and then they left again. And years later, it was found out they had gone into a religious sort of cult to hide. And then he was afraid of leaving there, not only because of John and Yoko, but because he didn't want them to take the girl back into the cult. So it was a big mess. And in the end, he did make a statement that he didn't realize how much pain he had caused Yoko, and it was a big mess. But later on, the girl ended up getting in touch when she was going to have her first child. She said, you know, the child needs her grandmother. So she reached out to Yoko, and they're great now. And Kyoko's an artist as well. And she has my book, and she's doing fine. She has 2 children.
Keep watching for more on Yoko Ono. And don't forget, please subscribe. It helps me and it allows you to find out when a new podcast is up on the platform. And thank you for watching. I mean, you talked about the acorn idea, facing in different directions, of both of them coming from very different worlds, and having very different perspectives, I presume, when they met. How did Yoko widen John's world?
They widened each other's worlds. I think John was looking outward. You know, he was getting into avant-garde art, other things besides music, and he wanted to speak out politically, but the Beatles management wasn't allowing him to. And here's this person who he could project everything onto, and she ran with him. They got together right away and hit the ground running with the Bed Ends for Peace and, you know, the Give Peace a Chance song, the music together. And, you know, she didn't really widen his world as much as let him live it and tell him that, you know, you don't have to listen to these other people. You don't have to, you know, conform like this. So,
well, in a sense, I think because he was interested in her, there's definite references like Imagine, which is in Grapefruit, where so the inspiration for one of the greatest songs of all time came from Yoko, but she wasn't credited on it until or later it was sort of came out, right. But initially not. So she obviously played an incredibly important role in inspiring him in his musical ventures as well.
Yeah, she could read notation. She was classically trained. You know, she could give him advice on arrangements. She could give him ideas about lyrics and told him when something was not good. You know, so she had an influence in every aspect of his life and he on her. And it was really one of the deepest love stories I've ever come across.
I mean, with Imagine, there's the film when they're at, I think it's called Tittenhurst, the home that they lived in, this in mm-hmm. you know, the white, beautiful white video in essence. Was that a place where they could both be free and both be themselves away from public view?
It was. They were constantly working when they were there. They were recording the Imagine album and they made the film there. But I don't know, both of them kind of thought it was too much for them. It was too isolated and too big. And they ended up going to New York City and staying and never going back. So they like that city environment.
I mean, you did touch on it, but her art took the back seat in a sense. I mean, she still carried on with her art, but in the public view, her art took a back seat because of the relationship with John. Do you know how she personally dealt with that?
She wouldn't have stopped it if she didn't want to. I mean, they were so much in love and, you know, they did a lot together. They did the Bed-Ins, they did concerts, they did the Acorn event, they did the Bagism, they did all kinds of, you know, things together. Her last major exhibition before John passed away was in 1971 at the Everson Museum. They had an entire three floors exhibiting her. It was a retrospective from like 62 to 71, and it was gigantic. And John really pushed that for her. And then, you know, in 72, they were on the concert. They did the concert in New York City with Sometime in New York City album, and that got panned. And that led to kind of the downfall where John went on a bender for 18 months.
The other wives of the Beatles, and I think this is where the sexism and misogyny comes in, because if Yoko had been a man and John Lennon had been a woman, I don't think the hate that was the vitriol and the hate that really came up against Yoko Ono would have appeared. And if you look at the other wives of the Beatles, because they conformed to the idea of maybe what society wanted at that time, I don't know. But Yoko Ono didn't conform. She did what she wanted. So you've talked about the sexism and the racism and possibly the misogyny. Where do you think it really lies, this terrible vitriol that there was against Yoko?
It lies in the fact that journalists were told to pepper up their stories with lies about her. And it's evident in one of the interviews I used some quotes from, was from Carolyn Kuhn, the writer from England, And it was an unpublished interview. And I said to her, why was this never published? It's beautiful. And she said, oh, the magazine wanted me to dirty it up and say that she had abandoned her daughter and all these other things. This is why. There's just lies out there.
What I loved as well is in the book, of course, you mention all the music, that everything that connects them, and the songs that are about their love for each other. And one of them, I Want You, She's So Heavy, and it's a track from Abbey Road, and I think it's about 8 minutes long or something. And it's just an amazing expression of the love that they had between them. When you were writing the book, and then I presume re-listening to all the pieces of music as you were doing it, what touched you the most?
Oh, the admiration he had for her was phenomenal. And her songs became more, less avant-garde and more of a delicate and beautiful because of her love for him. So that's what I noticed the most. And, you know, there are songs where they're together and he's just pining, you know, just declaring his love for her, and then when they're apart, he's also, you know, missing her during Mind Games, especially all those songs, Out the Blue and I Sue Miss N, which means I'm sorry, and Bless You, all these beautiful yearning songs. So they were nothing but good for each other.
You met Yoko Ono, and you've mentioned that, but you also had correspondence with her. You were a pen pal of Yoko Ono. What did you write about to each other?
Well, I would write about, I was young, okay, so I was like 13 when I started, and I would write about my loneliness as a child, and she kind of totally related to that. And we'd write about our mothers or the music. I'd always ask about her music and her art, and then when we finally met, she would invite me to these exhibitions and concerts, and she was just so happy that I totally understood her meanings, and she was so happy to talk to me about it all.
We've also mentioned that Yoko Ono, as an artist, and nearly all artists, I presume all artists, are uncompromising in their work. They do what they want to do and put out what they want to put out. Do you think that Lennon learnt that from her? Because previously, being in a band, I presume there always had to be, even if there were challenges, there were always had to be compromise in the end. Do you think that what he could have learned from her was also to be absolute uncompromising in what he wanted to do?
Yeah, definitely. She'd tell him, you know, you don't have to do this, you don't have to do that, do what you want. And yeah, the first album out of the gate was the John Lennon Plastic Ono Band, and that was a gut-wrenching record. It's fantastic.
Yeah, because the other thing about Trauma, of course, is that she had a miscarriage. And the heartbeat of the child that they lost was, I mean, it's absolutely heart-wrenching and moving to hear that.
It is. And you know, there are silences on the record, you know, for you to kind of just reflect or add what you want, and kind of an homage to John Cage. So she really opened him up, you know, and that two virgins was kind of nutty, where they were both, you know, kind of experimenting there and people didn't get it.
When John was shot, he was carrying the tapes. He was with Yoko, he was carrying on the tapes and of Walking on Thin Ice. And he was, he managed to enter the Dakota building and the tape fell out of his hand on the floor, and you know, the rest we know. And that evening, or shortly after that, I think it was that evening, she re-recorded a vocal in the studio, didn't she, I think? She went back to re-record
it. It wasn't that quickly, but yeah, she did record it and finish it. And she has a whole dedication on the picture sleeve of the single to John. You know, I did my best, you know, this is it. And did a video for it and premiered it, I believe it was at the Ritz in New York City on a big screen almost a month after John had passed away. and I was there. It was really heartbreaking, but it's a fantastic song. And years later, it did hit number. John used to say, you know, you may hit your first number one, Yoko, just like George Martin had said to the Beatles. And years later, when she started doing these remix releases, it did hit number one on the dance charts.
I mean, I think for me personally, I remember when that song came out and I played it endlessly. And in a sense, because I was never really, you know, to my shame probably, but I was never really a fan of the Beatles because my brothers were, and I wanted to not like what they liked. I think it was as childish as that. But when that record came out, it was the first time that I think really experienced pain, the raw pain in music. But it wasn't, it was inspired by something else, wasn't it?
What, that song?
Yeah. It was inspired by a trip. The song was
an older song. Well, yeah, to what's the lake called now?
Michigan.
Lake Michigan. She's gone there with John and she's seen Lake Michigan. And that whole part, that middle part, I knew a girl who tried to walk up, that was inspired by Lake Michigan. But the song, you know, the B-side of the song, It Happens, was an older song that she had laying around. And it happens at a time of my life that I least expected. And you don't know what it is that happened, but a lot of her songs were very prophetic. And I have a whole chapter about, you know, premonitions that she had. And
This sort of relates to Seasons of Glass, doesn't it? Her fifth album. And that album had His Bloodied Glasses on the cover. One of the most beautiful things that she was able to do was that she was able to give us her pain. Mm-hmm. How important do you think that was to her healing?
It was major for her, but a lot of people, it alienated a lot of people because they couldn't take it. They thought it was, you know, tasteless to do that, or they have this hatred of her already. And it just comes up as another example of why they wouldn't like her. But she wanted to show people what they had done. It wasn't just the killer who, you know, they were attacked from all angles. The whole world was trying to pull them apart all the time, and all their energy was spent on trying to stay together. And you know, it was a lot for them.
I mean, you mentioned that point, but the song that she wrote after Lennon's death that had "Hate Us, Hate Me, We Had Everything," and it's very weird in a way that it took his death for her to be accepted in any way. So I just wondered how she felt about the sudden change of heart of the world to Yoko Ono when she was so vilified before.
It was strange to her. She said that, you know, after he died, there was piles and piles of mail. And she thought, oh my God, it's all for John. And then she realized a lot of it was for her. And she answered every one of those letters. And there was a girl who told her that John had died on her birthday. And Yoko wrote her back and said, you know, don't think of this as a sad day. Think of it as the day John's soul was set free to travel the universe. And she continued sending this girl a birthday card for decades.
It's amazing how she was able to deal with trauma in a way to, again, turn something so negative into something so beautiful and positive.
Especially the most horrible thing that happened to her personally.
She became the keeper of his legacy, and she'd been seen as the person who'd ruined a legacy. Do you know what I mean? Exactly. It's a bit bizarre that those two things went together. Did she ever talk about that?
Well, in the beginning, she said, you know, as soon as she married John, she wakes up the next day and the whole world is her mother-in-law. You know, she knew it would be a big deal, but she didn't know there would be that much, backlash, you know, and it was bad. She received voodoo dolls in the mail in the shape of her with pins in them, John got calls saying, be careful, she'll slit your throat in the night. Just insane.
Also, after his death, really started to get the recognition that she always deserved. Not only musically along the way, as you already mentioned, I think she had quite a huge number of number one dance tracks from the remixes and everything. And also she, you know, got recognition from the Museum of Modern Art, from all these retrospectives that she had of her art. How do you know how that made her feel to finally get that sort of recognition?
She was over the moon about it. I mean, she had done a little thing in 1971 where she put up signs at Museum of Modern Art and declared it's Yoko Ono, one woman show. And she put an ad in the paper for it. She had a catalog printed and she had a guy standing at the entrance and saying to people, hey, what did you think of the Yoko Ono show? And they were confused. Some of them said, oh yeah, great, whatever. And then MoMA calls her up and says, hey, what's going on? Are you having a show here? You can't be having a show here. She says, oh, wait, I am, but it's just in my mind, so don't worry about it. And then decades later in 2015, there it is, MoMA, one minute woman show. So it's, you know, how you think positive about something you want, visualize it, it will happen. That's kind of what happened. And now in February, she has a huge one coming up at the Tate in England, and they're all over the world, her exhibitions. It's wonderful.
What has writing this book helped you further understand about Yoko Ono that you didn't maybe understand before?
More of what she had to endure, basically. I mean, I always understood her and what was important to bring forth about her work and her art and the meaning and her philosophy and her wisdom and all the things that people should really know about. But just how bad the hatred was and how well and graciously she handled it.
You mentioned earlier about in New York, and I've forgotten the woman's name, Mormon is her surname. Charlotte, was it? Charlotte Mormon. Mormon. Yeah. Okay. She really talked about what Yoko's legacy would be. Can you tell me what she said?
She told the New York Times in 1989 that 100 years from now, it's not John Lennon people are going to, or the Beatles that people are going to remember, it's Yoko Ono.
So how do you feel about that quote?
I think it's wonderful. Who knows?
I think
the Beatles are pretty strong, you know, the Beatles are going strong, and partly due to Yoko, you know, and the whole Apple team, you know, repackaging all these 50th anniversary box sets and, you know, diligently remixing and remastering. Sean is a part of doing the John Lennon boxes. They're meticulously done. They're beautiful. Books coming out just to perpetuate the legacy in the music. And, you know, the Beatles carry on that long, they'll be just as famous as Yoko is 100 years from now, I think.
I just want to ask you about the cover.
The cover is a wonderful illustration of Yoko that I think represents her throughout the decades. And it was a greeting card I found online, and it was by an artist, Australian artist called Kat McGuinness. And she allowed me to use it, and I'm so thrilled. We're both happy, and Yoko loves it too.
As I said at the beginning, this book is definitely a labor of love. It's, you know, it's definitely from someone who really wanted to achieve and get everything from Yoko's life into this book. So it's sort of the definitive biography written in a different style, in a sense. And it also has quotes which underline what you've put in the book. Can you explain those?
Sure. Well, all my life I've collected every magazine that she's ever had an interview in, and radio interviews and all. And I guess since I was a kid, there was nothing much going on in life at the time. And I remembered, you know, what she said in which magazine, and I have it all chronologically saved. So I was able to, you know, if I'm writing about this particular album, I'm like, oh, she said this in NME 1974. And I grabbed the quote when she's talking about what the song means or things like that. But, you know, I always liked books and reviews that are written by a fan of the person, because why would anyone write about a book about somebody they don't like? You know, it's only gonna, you're just gonna dig up dirt and have to just try to make it exciting and do research. And people say, oh, you did so much research. I'm like, no, I didn't. I knew what it had to be said, and I knew where it was in my closet, and I knew it was on the, you know, my tapes, and I knew where it was in letters from her, and I just put it all together.
There's a quote from Yoko about her own epitaph, and it's just such a wonderful quote, and it's towards the end of the book, obviously, and it is, here is a woman who loved life and still does, as her epitaph. It's absolutely beautiful, and it does say to you that this is someone who's still alive as long as her art is alive, for me.
Exactly. Yeah. Could be in another life as well, in another life with John somewhere else.
I just want to congratulate you again, because it is a wonderful book. It is, I mean, I thought I knew a lot about Yoko Ono. And there is so much in there of value, and so many amazing, touching, wonderful stories, and not just the love story, which is, you know, obviously a big attraction for the book, but particularly about her art and what she has achieved in her life. And I think the music side, which today is also seen in a very different light by many, many people. So I just want to say at the end, Madeline Boccaro, thank you so much, and congratulations on the achievement of this wonderful book.
Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate it. I'm so happy you liked it.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.